coincides with a revised edition of his book, Injustice, Why Social Inequality Still Persists. It was described by Matthew Taylor, the chief executive of the RSA, as a brilliant analysis of the nature of inequality in the UK and a must read for anyone who wants to understand inequality and how we might tackle it. With colleagues, Danny has created a website, worldmapper.org, which provides maps of global inequalities. His work has attracted a lot of public attention, and he speaks regularly at public events and on TV and radio. And he's also been advisor to many policy organisations and is increasingly engaging with and addressed by, as you saw, by policy makers. So I couldn't think of a better person to give this lecture this evening, and warmly welcome Danny Doyle. Sorry for jumping your slide.
Thank you very much, Dee, for that. Can you hear me at the back okay? Great. This is a picture of my dad. And I want you to tell me afterwards whether you think I am beginning to look like him. I'm ageing. There's a picture of me a few years ago, and I'm afraid I have to use these. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to read a whole lecture out. There's just one bit I do need to read. Before I do that, what I've chosen to do this evening is take what I think is the most interesting part of this book called Injustice. It's the bit which I had to update the most in doing the second edition of the book, which has just come out. And it may be the most contentious part, and it's certainly the part that has got most to do with education, so it fitted for this lecture. And it's about the word potential and theories of potential. Because when you begin to look at the persistence of inequality, particularly the persistence of inequality in the most unequal of rich nations, and we are heading that way. The USA currently is winning the global race to be the most unequal of large rich nations, but I'm afraid we're on track at some point in the next 20 years to overtake it, the way things are going. When inequalities are this high, it's hard to work out why they are this high and what sustains them. And what I did in Injustice was to look behind the reports and rhetoric of many people to try to find out whether they thought inequality was a bad thing or not. And there is a group of people who actually think that the inequalities that we have in this country are partly a natural expression of people's innate differences. And it helps that group of people justify what they do. It certainly helps people at the top of the Conservative Party at the moment. And I have lots and lots of quotes in Injustice from people who are currently cabinet ministers when they reveal in fairly obscure speeches what they really believe about the nature of human beings, which helps explain why they do what they do. But first of all, let me just read you this. Some of you may think that you've come to listen to somebody with a brilliant mind, a celebrated Oxford professor, no less. However, there is a problem. I haven't got a brilliant mind. I'm not good at writing. Much that has been published with my name on it has been rewritten by many other people. I was a very slow reader. I still am, as you can tell as I try to read this out. I'm not bad at mathematics, but I'm not exceptionally good. I do manage to remember a lot of statistics, but no more than many people remember about their favourite sport. Other than that, my memory is poor. I'm a non-starter when it comes to other languages. I do work much harder than I need to, which may be exceptional in academia once you get your foot on the ladder. However, I do not work much harder than many men in low-wage jobs, and I probably do not work as hard as most women in Britain do. In many ways, I am of average ability. Now, before you go away saying what a modest person I am, I have to admit that my dad wrote this bit. And he wrote it because it is true. And the purpose of my lecture is to show you how that, or something very similar to it, has to be true. none of us are actually that special. Meet Toby. I've never met Toby. Toby lives down in Auckland, and Toby's a cartoonist. A year or so ago, Toby met somebody called Max, and Max writes about inequality in New Zealand. Toby hadn't thought about the kind of ideas that Max thinks about, but when Max explained to him what was going on in New Zealand, a pretty unequal country, not as unequal as we are, Toby became interested in it, so interested that he produced a couple of series of cartoons. These cartoons went viral in the last few months. They've gone viral around the world. You may well have seen them, but I'm going to use them to try to make the points I've got to make. They're about a boy and a girl, and the boy's called Richard, and the girl's called Paula. And it's pencil swords, or pencils words is where it is if you want to find these. And here they are. This is Richard, and this is Paula. And it's about what happens to them. Now, there'll be a huge range of factors about what determines their life chances. I could have shown you lots of tables and lots of graphs and lots of figures, but I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is use this series of cartoons, and then I'll just talk over them to make the points. The vast majority of the factors that matter for the future of these two little babies have to do with the nature of society in which they're born. Had they been born somewhere other than New Zealand, or had they been born at another time in New Zealand, say in the 1920s, New Zealand invented the first welfare state in the 1930s before we invented one. Had they been born in a different place or different time, their trajectories would be very different. We know that because we know the outcomes of societies. But because these two fictional characters were born about 20 years ago in New Zealand, the range of possibilities for what they can turn out like is much wider. Most of what affects them are societal, but of course there may be individual factors that also matter, and this really dogs the potential debate. If you imagine for a moment that they weren't Richard and Paula, but were Richard and Paul, and were actually identical twins separated at birth, then they would look the same. And that would let us take out the influence of whether one of them was prettier than the other one. And I'll go on about this a bit later. This kind of story will be so familiar to you. The story of one child growing up in a family with lots of resources and another growing up in a family without many resources, that you don't need to see the figures and the evidence that says just how important it is. But in Britain, we tend to forget the huge differences that there are between people in different groups. We tend to be obsessed by very, very individual things, or things we can think we can have an effect on. So I'll give you one example. There's a kind of middle-class obsession with summer-born boys. I've got a summer-born boy. We tend to worry about our summer-born boys because we know that boys born in summer will tend to fall behind in school more than other boys, and certainly more than girls who do better than boys nowadays. But the amount by which boys who are born in summer fall behind is absolutely trivial compared to just being a boy in a slightly poorer family. The difference between families by wealth or families by area by wealth is orders of magnitude greater than the effect of being born at different times of the year. But you feel stuck in your social position. You feel stuck in your social class. You know, you've got that, you can't alter it very much. But you could choose to have sex at a different time of the year if you were really statistical. Nobody need have a summer-born boy anymore. I think it's very nice to see that lots of summer-born boys are still born, so the population isn't that obsessive. About context and change. Here we've got Paula, and one problem that Paula has is that she doesn't see much of her parents because her parents, each of them, or her one parent, depends, are doing two jobs. We're now in an era of people having to do two jobs. In the US, people often do three jobs just to get by. That wasn't the case a generation or two generations ago. It's all about the context and the changing context that we're living in. We know that schools matter. Here the school teacher is drawn. They're identical, the same person. You take the same teacher and put them in one school as opposed to another, and it's so much easier to do a better job in one school as opposed to another. I'm talking to people in education, so I hardly need to tell you this. All I'll say, one interesting thing for moving from Sheffield to Oxford is that in Sheffield I knew lots of teachers of my age. I moved to Oxford, and I've been to a lot of schools in Oxford in the last 2 years. In most of the schools, there are hardly any teachers of my age. In a lot of the schools, there are hardly any teachers aged over 25, because they get sick of losing all their income in rent and they leave. Most of the heads I've met in Oxford are younger than me. It isn't easy to be a teacher in Oxford and to stay in Oxford because of the house prices. And so that affects what happens to the schools. There's some text there you can read about how people look and the effects on that, because these kind of things may also matter. We tend to judge people by their looks. There are studies of this, of course. There are famous old 1960s studies about how West Indian children are treated differently. There are much more recent studies about when teachers are asked what they think of children, we find that the ones that they think are slower, they tend to judge being slower, and they tend to treat their children in a different way, and that has an effect on the children. I think we need much more work being done on how people look and how we treat people by how they look. The way we could do that work is actually by looking at identical twins. The problem is that identical twin studies don't tend to look at the effects of your visual appearance. They tend to be trying to look for other things. Grades are a recent invention. The idea of grading people, of having exams, so many exams, is very, very recent. When I went to school, there were no tests. No tests until I was 16. Our obsession with testing at the moment is very new. We're about to test, I think, all 4- and 5-year-olds in English state schools in September. We're going to baseline test them. Now, you can look at groups of children and use tests to make predictions about them. Any individual 4- or 5-year-old, your tests are going to be incredibly unreliable. When you're looking at what happens to people, a series of things happen to them. Each one may appear to be small, but they build up. Individually, chance matters enormously. If you think about all your lives, what's happened to you, how you come to be sitting in this lecture theatre tonight, there were chance events. You'll all be able to say what the chance events were, but you all have your own individual story. And then on top of those chance events, and they could be good luck or bad luck, there will be your social position. What happened to you? Whether somebody gave you a leg up? Were you sent to a school in which most people went on to university, or a different kind of school? Did you get that job because somebody helped you get that job and put you in a position to know how to do it? Or are you in a different kind of a job because nobody actually helped you at that stage, and so you're in a slightly lower grade position, and it's not about you, it's about the circumstances that you found yourself in. For young people today, the kind of questions are, did somebody find you an unpaid internship so that you could work in London and get a foot on the ladder? Much more importantly, Is there somebody who's going to lend you £40,000 to give you a chance of buying that really, really awful flat in Barking and Dagenham that without £40,000 you haven't got a hope in hell of getting? And that's the difference between somebody who decides that their long-term career is going to be in London and somebody who leaves. Young people know this in London now, and they're angry about it. They really don't like the idea that where you are going to get to in life, your potential, depends increasingly on your parents' wealth and not how well you work. They're kind of sold with the idea of meritocracy. Meritocracy is great because we've tested them so much, we've given young people the idea that they differ in ability, and if you work hard, you should be rewarded. And so it's particularly annoying to enter a world, in fact, it doesn't matter how hard you work, if you can't buy that flat, you know, you really have to go after some point, because landlords, some are nice, most are not nice, and as soon as you start a family, you cannot carry on with private landlords in London and be in a happy situation. Because they'll increase the rent, you can't pay it, you've got to move, and your children have to move, and so on. Let's keep taking you through Toby's slides. I like these slides. I think they help explain a lot of things that social scientists spend a long time trying to explain very, very simply. Of course, it's all much more complicated than that, so that's why you have to write a book. Well, that's the excuse for writing a book and not the paper. I wrote a short book called Inequality of the 1%, which details some of this, but injustice really is packed with everything I can find. And as far as I can see, and as far as I can test by testing out these arguments with other people, we have so much more potential to think and to dream and become better than we are collectively. We don't sit as atomized individuals, each becoming mini geniuses if we can on our own. We produce things in groups. That's how we work. The idea of a meritocracy in which there are a set of individuals and you can keep on training and grading them and eventually find a few golden children and project them up to the top completely ignores the fact that we do things well when we do them together. Just like producing a book. A book is produced by dozens of people, lots of copy editors, proofreaders, editors, people who sell it, friends who read the drafts of what you've written, people who teach you what you learned that first gave you your bias that you often can't lose the rest of your life. You know, it's an incredible collective effort. And then you do this stupid thing of sticking somebody's name on the front cover to make it look as if it's all about them. Now, somebody has to take responsibility, but if you could just see the very first drafts of anything that's written, particularly by somebody like me, the difference between that and what you finally see is enormous. And I often feel really sorry for university students, because when they're reading papers or books, they don't realise that this isn't something that somebody's just trotted out. These things really are polished. Nobody could actually do this on their own. And it's not just true of books, it's true of everything. It's true of this microphone. It's certainly true of this computer. Nobody can make a computer nowadays. You can't do it. You can't make a television on your own. Things are produced collaboratively. My eyesight really is going with age, so I'm going to leave these glasses on. What happens to you later? What happens when somebody promotes you or doesn't promote you? Or what happens when somebody bullies you at work and the effect that has on you? And why does it happen? And how do you decide when you interview three people for an undergraduate place at Oxford or five people for a lectureship at King's, which one to take? Is it all based on merit? The three people going for the undergraduate degree at Oxford, after all, are remarkably similar, A star, A star, A. I'll never forget a student when I was up at Sheffield on an open day saying to me, what kind of students come here to the Geography Department of Sheffield? And she'd just come over the Pennines from Bolton and had ABB predicted A-level and was wearing some fairly sporty clothes. And I had to say to her, I'm afraid they tend to have AAB at A-level, tend to live just over the Pennines in the northwest of England, and tend to wear fairly sporty clothes. you know, because that's the way we herd people together in education. Similarly, for that job interview, for that lectureship here, the five people you interview will be very similar to each other. They'll all have got a PhD, otherwise you wouldn't interview them. They'll all have got some papers, they'll all have a chance at a job. You might, when you're sitting there on the interview panel, say, oh, they're much better and they're not appointable and so on. But I'm now old enough to have watched almost my entire cohort of PhD students from the 1980s get a job. All of us who competed for those different jobs who are being interviewed against each other at various universities, partly because there are so few of us and there are actually more jobs in the future, we've all ended up professors now. But on the way to doing that, we were all being graded at various points, not very good, unappointable, brilliant, or whatever. But we were similar. So which ones do you go for? Who gets it? And again, that's why I think it will be interesting to look at the effects of looks, and whether people with particularly chiseled cheekbones or people who are thinner are more likely to get the university appointment, the studentship, or whatever. Brilliant undergraduates are remarkably thin at Oxford, that's all I'll say. You know, if it's entirely on merit, why aren't some of the A star A people who are slightly larger sizes? Anyway, I must not get myself into trouble about these things, and I think we need to look. Our potential is limited by our cultures. A really good example of this is language. As my dad's told you, I am utterly useless at languages. It's not an innate thing about me. There isn't something in my genes that means I can't do language. I was born in England in 1968. Right? Some of the others of you have this experience. Do you remember doing that bit of French when you were about 14? What you were made to do in those language labs? The idea that you stick this thing on your head and that will teach you another language. Right. We are utterly abysmal at languages. My mum and dad have a couple of friends who they made friends with because they were locked up in the Campsfield Detention Centre in Oxford, in Rwanda. They could speak four languages. Wasn't impressive. It was normal. That's what you do in most of Africa. You speak several languages. The ability to speak language, and I think it's the same with music and even maths, most of it is cultural. Or another anecdote. I was at a wedding a few years ago, and I was standing next to somebody from Brazil, and she was watching everybody dance at this wedding. And she leant over to me and she said, "You English, you teach your children to swim, but you don't teach them to dance." There is nothing inherent in being English that means you cannot dance at a wedding. Right? It's cultural, I'm afraid. It may take decades, if not centuries, to get to a position where we can dance again. But we don't take it as seriously as other places do. Inequality is created and maintained and defended by the theory that different people have greatly different worth, that their children have usually varying potentials. And because their children have hugely varying potentials, we need different schools for them to go to. We need some schools which will cost as much as £35,000 a year to educate a child, another £15,000 for the school trips. The only way you can defend that, I think, is that you have entrance examinations, say at 13, and you just let in the ones who could benefit from such a supposedly wonderful education. And because you're spending so much money on such a small number of children, we spend about 25% of our secondary education spending, public and private, on just 7% of children, and most of that just on a minority of those 7%. Because you're spending so much on a small number of children, you're going to spend less on other children. And if you think this is a good thing, you have to think, well, those children are never going to be up to much. But then you could think, oh, that could be a bit mean. Supposing there was a child who goes to that badly funded school who could do a lot. Let's go looking for them. Let's give them a baseline test at age 4 or 5 just to spot whether they are there. And if they do particularly well at age 4 and 5, let's push their teacher to push them further and set targets that are higher. And search the few able ones out from the masses so that they can join our children, who are all destined to be brilliant, because our children, of course, are really gifted. Very, very, very clever. Surprised me how clever my children were. It's not a normal way to think or behave. It doesn't happen to this extent in most of the rest of this continent. There are problems and differences and gradings of educational systems in the rest of this continent, but nowhere has the kind of segregation that we have by whether your mum and dad could actually afford to pay the fees. Nowhere else in Europe touches it. If you want to compare cities, compare Oxford and Bonn. They're twinned, German city and English city, and compare the schools. It takes quite a long time and several bottles of beer to get a German school teacher from Bonn to actually rank the schools in the city of Bonn, because none of them are that bad, and none of them are that brilliant. And the private school, it's not for the clever kids. It's for the rather slow children of the extremely rich who have trouble in the mainstream schools. And what every German knows, and hardly anybody here knows, is that the most famous alumni of that school in Bonn, near Bonn, is Prince Philip. Because I've been immersed in this debate now for about 10 years, my friends who think I am too much of a hippie repeatedly send me papers about genetic effects being found and so on. Gene studies are changing rapidly. So only 2010 that somebody produced a statistical method to analyse genome-wide effects. So I'm sure these kind of things might come up in the question, so I'll leave it to later. But the most important thing to know about genetic effects is that we are only very recently getting genome-wide studies. They're showing very small effects that are smaller than the gap between boys and girls at age 50. People are trying to do analysis of nature and nurture, and they're doing it at King's. This is figure 2 from a paper I sent this week, and I'm just going to put it up for you. It's supposedly the nurture effects on ADHD. Okay? So it's an attempt, I think, I could have got it wrong, and if I have, I apologise, but as far as I can tell, reading the description of the figure and asking other people to tell what the figure is, this figure was put in the paper to demonstrate an attempt to look at nature and nurture effects, and this is the nurture effect on ADHD. Now, I'm not very good at writing or reading, but I've drawn more maps of Britain than anybody has ever drawn in British history. Because I am weird. I've drawn thousands and thousands of maps of Britain. So when I see a map of Britain and I see a pattern, I try to work out what pattern does it look like that I've seen before. And there's only one pattern that I've seen that looks like that before, and I'll show you in a minute. But essentially, unless the BT tower is sending out some kind of radioactive signal, which has an amazing effect that is almost purely circular, that cannot be the nurture effect on ADHD. The pattern it's most similar to is a thing called population potential that comes from human geography. That has nothing to do with educational potential. It's just a measure of how many people are near you. But it's similar. We're at the very infancy of looking at genome-wide effects. We've had twin studies for a very long time, but identical twins look like each other. You can't have identical twins that do not look like each other, and how you look has an effect on how people treat you. If we had an identical twin study in a country where they wear the veil, then maybe we could look at that different, but we do not. These studies are very important for many things. They're extremely important for working out the genetics of being obese and fat. And some of us have genes that mean that unless you lock us up in a small room and slide cabbage underneath the door, put you in an obesogenic environment and you're going to get fat. And that's the luckily ones among you are the other Y inclined. Right? Genes matter for all kinds of things. There are lots of genetic effects. But education and knowledge is a much different and complicated thing. I sometimes look at the work that's done on genes and education. I think, would somebody do this for flower arranging? Would you try and work out the genes that make somebody better at flower arranging than somebody else? Right? Flower arranging is a socially constructive skill. It depends on whether you ever come across it and whether you're trained or not. There are very big biases. It tends to involve more women than men. WI particularly into it. You know, but you could, if you really wanted to, get hold of the DNA and try to work out who was the best flower arranger. And it's not particularly helpful. Because we're not atomized individuals. We really are not. If you've seen the film The Matrix, we are not a set of people sitting in tubs, you know, with a tube in us sucking out our ability and energy to imagine. And it really matters just how we are. We live in a society and that determines our ability to be clever or to be stupid. It's not an individual thing. It's not an individual attribute. Knowledge, learning, being clever, being stupid is worked out collectively. People in more unequal rich countries are, on average, more stupid a little bit more often. We've seen this anecdotally. Apologies to Americans in the audience, but you'll know the stereotype. Americans are more likely to be brass and say things that seem a bit more brass and that haven't thought about what they're saying. It's not Americans' fault. That's what happens in a more unequal country. When we loudly talk in cities in mainland Europe, we come over like Americans come over in Britain. It's slightly shocking to be told that and to think about it because you think, oh, we're ever so reserved and careful and subtle, aren't we? Young Europeans who live in London always comment about the class system here and just how obvious it is. It's not obvious to us because we're used to it. Here's the New Zealand website if you're interested in the work that Max did that made Toby want to draw those cartoons. They're trying to spark a debate about income gaps and the damage they do and how to narrow them, and about whether there's fair competition or unfair competition. And on the front of their website is simply a picture of a school in New Zealand. And if you know anything about society and how things work, and you only got to know a little bit about New Zealand, the way New Zealand society segregates people into different areas and into poor schools and rich schools, they're actually called SR1 and SR10 schools, alters the future trajectory of New Zealanders' lives. There's nothing innate in these children that means that they are less likely to do well in future. It's the nature of New Zealand society as it is now and how children are funneled in particular directions. I'm going to speed up a little bit. Here's one more cartoon for Toby. I may be a bit too obsessed by my Toby at the moment. Those pie charts are about how many children a few years ago got 5 A to C's and GCSEs. The little one down the bottom is private schools. Send your child to a private school, they're almost certainly going to succeed. They have to. People aren't that stupid, apart from in Germany. You don't spend that money if you don't get the results. The comprehensive figures from a few years ago, only 39% were passing. The selective grammar schools and church schools, I think, are included there. The bulk of them are church schools, actually. Majority of children were passing 5 A to C's. And then the tiny number of secondary moderns, what in effect are secondary moderns in counties with grammar schools doing really badly. When you have selective schools the way we do, and they're becoming more selective over time, they tell pupils that they're more clever than other children. That's what, you've passed the 11 plus, you must be more clever. Children have got no way of knowing whether they're more clever than other children, because they don't get to go to the other schools, so they believe it. They're then trained in how to pass exams, which really is a useless skill later in life. And these are exams right at the very top. What differentiates a final honours student in Oxford from a final honours student in Sheffield is if I find one of the students in Oxford, will write 12 or 13 or 14 pages in one of their three essays in 3 hours. So that the poor sod marking it has to read an enormous amount of words. That's what the university I'm at in the social sciences trains them to do. They all know that they've got to try to get to that second answer book and start filling it in, because if you haven't written that much, you might not get the first. Teaching children to regurgitate dates and references as much as they can and write as fast as they can in exams in the summer, what possible use later on in life does that ability have? How we are treated really matters. And it's very hard for any of us to judge this, because of course we're only treated in one particular way. I remember many years ago seeing Tony Blair. Saw him twice. The first time I saw him was a normal Tony Blair experience. He was being famous and everybody around him was smiling. Many people had only met Tony for the first time that day. Quite a lot of them didn't really like him. But they are still smiling, because that's kind of what you do when you're in the presence of celebrity. And I thought, what must it be like to be Tony Blair? And what happens to you every day is that you meet all these people you don't know and they smile at you as if you're great. The second time I met Tony Blair was the day he had to resign. And nobody was smiling, they were all looking a bit uncomfortable, because the event had meant to be a bit different. And Tony looked very small and short and not very happy. Pygmalion quote: the difference between a lady and a flower girl is not how she behaves, but in how she is treated. I just see this all the time. I see it when people ignore people around them who are cleaning up around them. I see it when people ignore the security staff as they walk into a place like this. And I see it as people pay a lot of attention to somebody like me and you put forward in this way. It changes what you think about yourself. And in a society where people are more likely to look up and doff their cap, more likely to look down at their shoes and not try and cause a fuss, that grinds on you, it has an effect. I won't say anything about the sorting hat in Harry Potter, except... well, I'll read it out for you, but there's nothing hidden in your head. The sorting hat can't see, so try me on and I will tell you where you ought to be. The sorting hat comes up with a different rhyme every year. The rhyme more recently has had some doubt into whether the sorting hat thinks that the sorting hat is getting it right or not. One more example of the kind of thing I get sent. I was sent a paper again last week titled Demonstrating the Validity of Twin Research in Criminology. You may not know about this because this is a talk about education, but in criminology there is a burgeoning part of criminology that tries to work out, do some people have criminal genes that makes them criminal? In fact, there's a famous New Zealand study of a very tiny group of people in Dunedin where this came from. So the idea is some of us are delinquent, some aren't delinquent. If we can spot the people with the criminal genes, maybe you could teach them to try not to be criminal early on or whatever. Now, being criminal or not is a product of your time and your place. We used to have hardly any prisons 400 years ago, very little crime. We now have a prison boom. We have more prisoners here in England per head than anywhere else in Western Europe. That, I would say, is because of what's happened to our society. It's not that we have suddenly become more criminal, or that the criminal genes have expressed themselves that our grandparents somehow didn't have. It doesn't work. In the US, there are 2 million people locked up in prisons. It's the highest rate in the world. There was only one year when one country managed to beat the US, and that was Rwanda, when they locked up all the people who'd taken part in massacres in prisons. And then Rwanda only just got a slightly higher rate of people in prison than the US There is nothing inherently criminal in citizens of the United States of America. I've lost my slide. This paper, demonstrating the validity of twin research and criminology, was attacking a paper that said that really looking at genetics for crime is silly. By silly, I mean fraught with problems. The paper by some geneticists was very angry because the critics of the geneticists said identical twins are of the same sex, and so there will be a correlation between their outcomes because they're male and male or female and female, particularly for crime. Crime rates are incredibly different for men and women. In that paper, you can find a statement that says, where is the evidence that what happens to men and women is different? It's the most ridiculous. I've got huge volumes of books on my shelves about gender differences and outcome. It's a really, really fraught area. It's very, very bitter, but it matters. Because our previous Education Secretary, Michael Gove, really believed this. We are labelling children in ways that have damaged them greatly. This is the distribution of ability of children in the Netherlands according to the PISA results. So if you've met the Dutch, you may not know that about 3% of them have almost no ability, 11% of the Dutch are limited, 20% have barely adequate ability, 28% are simple, and it's not until you get to the 25% who have some effective ability, this is age 15 or 16, that you get any Dutch person who is even slightly useful. And then you get the 11% who are developed, and then you get the super 2% advanced. PISA have dropped those labels since I did the first edition of Injustice. It wasn't me, other people said, what are you doing? They've kept the methodology exactly the same, but they no longer use those words. There's a lot of that going on. I've got too many slides, so I'm going to go through them a bit more quickly, and I'll just let you read the kind of things I say. But if you're thinking about what happens to children and how they do and how they develop educationally, just think about the economic environment of their parents. Between the 80s and before the crash, 6% of parents on average were finding it difficult to get by, very difficult. 15% were finding it difficult. Almost half were only coping financially. So slightly under a third of us for those decades said we're living comfortably. If you're not living comfortably as a parent, doing all the kind of other things you're supposed to do to help a child, it's very hard, let alone what happens if one of you falls ill, if you divorce, what happens to the kids then, or if you're private renting and you've got to move and the kids have got to move school and again, 25% of kids in England are now living in private rented accommodation because of what's happened to the housing market. There'll be a higher proportion in London. Circumstances matter. So much more than their genes. This little tweet, somebody asked the Mayor of London, why are you such a weirdo? And his response on Twitter earlier this year was a mixture of my genes and upbringing, I expect. Most people who do well wouldn't be so conceited as to say, I am brilliant because I have brilliant genes. It's a really arrogant thing to say, isn't it? Think about it. But there are people at the top of society in Britain, including the Mayor of London, who thinks he's brilliant and thinks the reason he's brilliant is a bit of his experience, but his special genes. And this matters because these views are commonly held at the top of society. They are very well hidden, because most people at the top of society know that they'll come over looking very crass if they say, I'm afraid most of you, the reason you're down there and I'm up here is, oh, I just have the better genes. You know, that's, you don't say it. more stresses or more changes that really matter and we should worry about. These are a series of studies over time. Each circle is a study. The size of the study is the number of participants. The date is when the study was taken, and the proportion is the number of, I think it's 15-year-old girls who were clinically assessed to be depressed at that point in time. We have lots of things to worry about, and we're making life worse for our children in many ways, adding the pressure of making schooling and education more competitive, or telling them that some of them are limited by what's inside them and some of them are going to be super. And if you're super, you've got to do really well. There's pressure at the top end of society as well as at the bottom. Let me just show you what PISA still produce. This is the distribution of ability in PISA tests from the 2012 latest ones. And look, they're all bell curves. They're all almost perfect bell curves. Amazing. The Netherlands, the UK, the USA. Slight differences, and I've even had a look at the changes over time. Ability distributed by a bell curve in all these countries. How can that happen? How can PISA have tested all these children and got something that looks as neat as that coming out? The reason is ever so simple. What PISA did and still does is test children, and then they scale the results so they fit a bell curve, and then they publish those numbers. So PISA are telling you that ability is distributed as a bell curve without telling you it wouldn't matter how children are done in the tests. It will come out as a bell curve like that from that organisation. And it's dangerous. And it matters because it can be hard getting through life and hard getting through society. This is the proportion of people taking Prozac in the equivalent in Scotland at the moment. Heading up to about 13%, the equivalent of 13% taking it every day, it's defined daily doses. The black line is when the first edition of Injustice came out, and it looked like things were at least trailing off. That's a ridiculous 10% of the population taking drugs that took you away from yourself so you could get through life. I'm not against Prozac, it's just, wouldn't it be nice to live in a kind of society where you didn't have to medicate to get through? And then of course the recession hits and then we are up again. You can find worse figures in America. The worst I've seen there are in Los Angeles, and the very worst are in Beverly Hills, in the richest parts of LA. So this kind of thing is not just about the poor. Behaving collectively, and I'm almost at the end now, you'll be glad to know. Behaving collectively. There are things you can do individually. You can decide not to smoke or to smoke. It's affected by your society, but not that much. And you can decide to drink too much or not to drink too much. But you cannot individually decide that you're going to engineer your city so it's really easy for you to walk to work. You cannot individually get out there and paint a cycle lane along a road unless you're very, very, very brave. But have a look at these differences. In the US, only about 3% of people walk or cycle to work. In the Netherlands, it's almost half. And there is a weak relationship with inequality. That's the take of the 1% along the bottom. We can behave in better ways where we behave better collectively. I think that this distribution is like it is, because some countries are better at controlling the rich than others. There'll always be a 1%. They'll always have most. The question is, how much do they have? Things go badly, badly out of control, as in the US, and 1% have got 20%. You do well, and in the Netherlands, they've got it down to 6%. And a society that is good at controlling its rich is also good at working out how housing and jobs should be distributed, and it's a good idea to make it easy to walk and cycle. But my reason for putting this up is, if the ability of the Dutch really is so identical to the ability of people in the USA, how come they're so different in other ways? Potential really is about politics. The idea that some people have potential and others don't have potential is really about politics. This is a blog by Reclaim Schools. about what is happening in our schools now, the testing being introduced, the direction it's going in. And it concludes that this is intrinsically reckless. It allows the rich to imagine that their own wealth and status must be part of the natural order. And Michael Gove and his advisor, let's not say sacked, I've forgotten what happened to Dominic Cummings, but it's rumoured he's going to lead the No campaign for leaving Europe so Dominic could be back again. They fell for this stuff, and it's not good. Let's end with Toni Morris. Toby's got another cartoon strip that I can't show you called The Tower of Inequality, and it really is worth looking at. But this is at the very bottom of the tower when he's asking, what can be done, what can we do? And then he produces a sort of series of things we could think about. And you could think about introducing things like a citizen's wage. You can do it at a very low level and then make it bigger. There's all kinds of things you could do. We tax people at less than almost every other country in Western Europe, so we have enormous scope to do things differently if we wanted to. But if we don't think there's any alternatives, if we think inequality is high in all countries and you've just got to compete to win a global race, and we don't know that other people in Europe behave differently and their schooling systems are different and they treat each other differently and they do not think that part of their society is to be written off and only a few people in their society are so great that they can rule, if we just don't know any of that, then we've got no chance of doing all the things that are better. And I'm just going to quote from Stephen Rhodes in Times Educational Supplement from, I think it's last year. Policymakers and educators don't need genetics to help them make better environments for our children. What is really lacking is the political will to make better environments for our children. Earlier this month, a group of primary school children in the Rose Hill Primary School in Oxford wrote to David Cameron, asking him if he could help make sure that their boiler doesn't break down again. Because last winter they had to sit in their coats all winter in school because the boiler was broken. Those are the kind of things you need to do if you're going to improve education. My last slide. You can achieve so much more by cooperation, by setting people up for these silly competitions. We all have skills and we all have abilities. Being cheerful, pleasant and kind are some of the most valuable abilities of all. We need each other, we need to work together because none of us are that special. Some of us do have disabilities, and sometimes there are genetic abnormalities that give us disabilities. The same doesn't happen the other way round. The golden child doesn't exist. There is no point setting out in a great hunt, like you look out for the next Dalai Lama, to try to spot that child who should be taken up to the ivory tower, because one day they can do PPE, and Vernon Bogdanov will give them a first, and then they can become Prime Minister and will make the world such a much better place. It's a fiction and it's very, very wrong. We can easily get things wrong because we don't vary greatly in ability, potential ability or realised ability. And we can also get things right by repeatedly asking for others to help us, correct us, and tell us when we're going down the wrong path. Thank you very much.
For those of you who don't know me, I'm Sharon Gewurz, Head of the Department of Education and Professional Studies. I'm sure there's a lot in Danny's lecture that you would like to ask questions about. And in a few minutes, Denise is going to invite you to ask some questions and begin a discussion which you can then carry on over drinks. But before she does that, it's my role and my pleasure to say a few words of response and appreciation to Danny on behalf of the department. Danny's lecture has reminded me of one of the core reasons why it's really important to have an education presence, and particularly a school education presence, in universities. As I'm sure those of you who work in schools will testify, with the best will in the world, it's very hard for teachers and other school workers who are immersed in the daily kind of grind of the classroom to step back and reflect on some of the deeper foundational purposes of schooling and the means by which to attain them. And that's the case, even when teachers know and feel in their bones that the whole system in which they're implicated and caught up in is so destructive and damaging to children's psychic well-being and physical well-being as well, as a result of the relentless sorting, selecting, grading, and labelling processes that Danny has talked about. Via events like this and through our postgraduate teaching programmes and undergraduate teaching programmes, university departments of education provide a much-needed space for such foundational debates. If we're seriously to follow through the implications of Danny's analysis, in other words, if we were to organise schooling around the spirit of cooperation, around what people have in common rather than what divides them, rather than the individualism that currently prevails, that would require a real sea change in how we think about school education. And as well as reorientating educational priorities, such reflections would also press home crucially important questions about how schools are dependent on broader social and cultural determinants and visions. For it's very difficult to imagine an education system organised around ideas of collaboration, collectivism, the equal valuing of different kinds of capability. It's difficult to imagine a school like that coexisting with the kind of society we have now, which is so individualistically, competitively and hierarchically ordered. A society where the ability to pass the academic exams, which Danny says isn't very useful at all, is valued over other kinds of capability, like the ability, in Danny's words, to be cheerful, pleasant and kind, or to care for others, or to clean, or work in security, or garden, or mend things. The debate around the kinds of schools we want, therefore, can't be separated out from the kinds of society that we want. And even if we disagree with some of Danny's readings and emphases, thinking through the implications of his analysis would still be a very worthwhile thought experiment. As it is, people working in schools, as many of you know, are under huge pressure to deliver and to constantly improve on officially sanctioned norms. And that means there's comparatively little opportunity, as I said before, to sort of step back and to think and to talk outside of those dominant norms and accountability frameworks, or to question whether schools are being held to account for the right things or being held to account fairly. And that last question about fair accountability looks set to become increasingly salient in the coming period as austerity is ratcheted up. As social and economic inequalities increase, as we can expect them to do following the substantial cuts that are about to be announced or have been talked about a lot in recent days in the welfare budget, so too will inevitably the attainment gap, because of that very strong link between economic and social inequality and attainment. And no doubt, as they are now, schools and teachers will be blamed for that attainment gap and under ever more pressure to close it. So at the very least, Danny's lecture should make us ask whether we are sure that things are progressing along the right tracks. And I wanted to say on behalf of the whole department how grateful I am and we are to Danny for such a brilliantly engaging and challenging lecture. And I would like to thank you and your father for writing it. Thank you. Also, for handing back over to Denise, take this opportunity to thank Denise very much, because in the last few years Denise has chaired these lectures, and unfortunately, sadly for us, this will be the last lecture that she can chair, because as some of you, most of you perhaps will know, Denise is moving on to Danny's institution, to Oxford University, to be principal of Templeton Green College at the end of July. And so I just wanted to add thank you to Denise. Thank you very much. So thank you to Sharon for very wise words. We now open the floor for discussion. We've got some microphones, I gather, and they are quite important in this room because although you can project forward very well, people behind you don't hear so well, so we would encourage you to use them. And could you give your name and affiliation before you ask your question to Danny? And I'm going to take two or three questions and then pass across to Danny, if that's all right with you, to keep some of the flow going. We have, about 10, 15 minutes for discussion here, and then there's drinks upstairs, so you can grab Danny on an individual basis and ask questions or comments to him at that point too. So the floor is open. I've got gentlemen back here and then lady at the back.
My name is Joe Evans, I'm a visiting fellow of this exception. I was enthused and inspired by what Dan said. A little bit troubled by the response. I know it's very difficult, very, very difficult, to contradict the received wisdom of the time, even if the received wisdom is absolutely wrong, as it is. That's what universities are for, isn't it? That's what we should be doing. And we should be trying to find a way of dismantling these extraordinary ideas on which so much of our existing government and their predecessors' education policy was based. I'm part of an organisation that campaigns against selection in education. The arguments are so well known, but are so ignored by those who see an interest in ignoring. And I think we should thank Danny for what he said today.
Thank you. Lady here. So I'm afraid, Ben, you're going to be running to the front and then back again. So keep you fit.
Hi, my name is Sarah Aspis. I'm a student at King's College at London University. I'm also a disabled student, and I also work in the Alliance for Inclusive Education Policy Campaigns Coordinator. I was interested in what you were saying about disability being genetic, and I think a lot of us would question that and would say that it's a social construct. So if you look at things like autism, yes, there might well be some genes that, like, there might be a continuum of genetics that might interact with the environment, that might cause some differences in how we behave, how we learn, how we perform. So therefore, all these labels like autism, ADHD, are all social constructs, because they're all ideas that have come to be that are different from the law, because we have an education system that's very much based on examination. Jobs. No, we haven't found out those middle range jobs. were being paid low, paid at a low rate. And in the context, that is kind of going back to our education system. You know, we don't talk really about the implications of segregated education for segregated children. So we talk about segregation of black children, we talk about segregation, the impact of children with school free meals, but we don't talk about the impact that segregation has in terms of the kind of the quality of education and the value of what they learn in the wider society.
Thank you. And I'll take.
Do you want to do those first?
Please do.
I have an inability to remember three questions.
Okay.
I can do two. Thank you very much for that in the back. I have enormous self doubt about this. There are interesting things coming out of the enormous numbers of studies, particularly since 2010, to do with geekiness and so on. But selection, I don't think, helps anybody. So I'll give you. And also, one thing that does help when you're worrying about arguing against the accepted wisdom of the time is just to think back a little bit. When I went to school, we were caned. Corporal punishment was seen as a useful thing to do. It was banned in state schools, and later it was banned in private schools. And any adult now who took a cane to a child would be in court. But at the time, and for decades, this was seen as a necessary good part of education. And if you just think about that, you can see there's always, for every generation, there's something that you did that future generations say, how on earth could they have done it? And I think it'll be selection in our case, because you're so lucky if you get to go to school with everybody else who lives near you, and even better if you get to live somewhere which has a mix of people. Not least because you can go home after school and your friends are on the same street as you. Simple things like that. Yeah, I was unclear about disabilities. I'll give you an example, which is again my dad. My dad has a very rare disability that he didn't know he had until later in life. He always had a huge fear of playing cricket. And his fear of playing cricket was that he wasn't very good at playing cricket, so he was out in the far field. And it was fine until occasionally a ball came, and he had to try and catch it. And he couldn't catch it, and sometimes it might hit him on the head. Later on in life, he was tested, and it's found that he didn't have binocular vision. His eyes don't actually work together. It's actually quite dangerous for crossing the road, but as long as you know you haven't got binocular vision, you can kind of take it into account. Now, it may be genetic or not or whatever, but it is a disability not having binocular vision. Not huge, unless they make you play cricket at school, which they did. But the point is that we all have disabilities. Often we don't know what they are. What we don't have is special abilities. So almost all of you have binocular vision. It's normal to have it. You all have opposable thumbs. There may be somebody in Britain who doesn't have an opposable thumb, but in general, an opposable thumb is a pretty useful thing to have. But the fact that my father doesn't have binocular vision, or that all other kinds of people differ from each other in various ways, doesn't mean that my dad isn't a particularly useful person in society. It just means that you wouldn't want to make him a cricket player. That's all. And I think that's my point about disabilities. But it's often suggested that there are these special genes that give you special powers, a bit like superheroes. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work for selection. You have incredibly common ones. The really advantageous things almost everybody has. But a few people don't have them. Some people will be blind. You can do brilliant things in life being blind. But it will be harder. Not as hard as being deaf. If you had to choose between being blind or being deaf, you should choose to be blind. But you have to know a bit about being blind and deaf to know that. And people who are blind and deaf can do incredibly more useful things in society than somebody whose eyes work and their ears work, but they're telling you stupid things that make society worse.
I think we've got the mainstream.
The gentleman.
My name is John Richardson. I'm a head of education, so it's the university. I'll ask a more question.
Thank you. The lady part way up there. And then we're at the front. Ben, are you happy to take two more?
Hello, my name is Catherine Rhodes. I work for the Department of Education, although I was a social researcher previously. I've got a very strong simple but tricky question, which is what are the policy changes that you think you need?
How long have you got? That's fine. And then we've got to the front.
Hello, I'm Simon Clifford. I'm a school governor. I'm also a Concerns Council and Association Vice Chair. And actually, it's similar to that, actually. I mean, picking up from speech, and I'm also the one who said speech at the RSA. In terms of the increased inequality in the problem area, and also your reference to the point you made about we're a fairly low tax nation. Do you think we're kind of close, with the inevitable radical change in employment over the next 10, 15 years because of automation, do you see that we're reaching a tipping point in terms of public awareness? Because I was at a speech last week at Brian Cox, and I asked him about whether he believed that the increased awareness of science and its importance was understood at that top level within government. And he recognised that it was, but government was telling them they didn't think there were the votes in it. And I think that's reflected in this subject too, that both science is our way forward, but also addressing this as a policy issue. If people don't come out vocally and support it, and vote with it, the change won't happen. And do you think we're reaching a moment of change where people will demand this change?
Okay.
Thank you. Very important question.
Okay. Yes, there needs to be more dialogue. That was me trying to be diplomatic, which I'm not enough. I did a review of GS for Genes in International Journal of Epidemiology less than a year ago, and the authors were invited to do a reply, and they haven't. So it's an attempt. The best place to do your dialogue is in academic journals, because there's referees and somebody calms you down. You know, this is not a good environment for doing dialogue in, with an audience of other human beings. Academic journals are the place to do these kind of things in. They can still be very childish and heated even there, but at least there's some space and some time. So if you remember the Spirit Level book, had a series of critics, and the critics refused to do their criticism in academic journals back. They just wanted to say the Spirit Level was rubbish. One of them is also somebody who loves smoking and doesn't believe it causes cancer. But it needs to happen. It will increase because of this huge increase in genome-wide studies, which again, the stats was developed in 2010. Most of the publications are 2014. There were lots of interesting little effects being found out about geekiness. They're much smaller, about an order of magnitude, 10 times smaller than the effects of twin studies are finding. Twin studies folks say that twin studies are the gold standard and find all these kind of things that genome-wide analysis can't find. But this is going to change, and it's been so recent. We do need to talk. The other thing is, if you look over time at the twin study claims, they kind of go from 3/4 is genetic to half to less over time. There's more things, so it's going down. And we should be able to learn things from twins. But like I say, most of all, how people are treated by how they look. You know, looks really do matter in our society. Policies, small and gradual. You know, so we don't do revolution here. We don't need to be spending $240 million opening free schools in areas where there is no need for new places. You wouldn't think we had austerity, would you? There's a whole lot of ways in which we're spending lots of money on baseline tests for 4- and 5-year-olds. We don't have lots of spare money. Spending money on unproven things, that's an immediate thing that we could do, which would be better. The other thing is I would look at the effects of children at the supposed top of these distributions of what is happening, because I think it is harmful for children to be constantly selected as doing as supposedly being brilliant. It just puts off the year in which you finally have a fall and fail. Life isn't rosy amongst the kids who get A star, A star, A. And if we were to look a little bit more about the disadvantages of this for the ones we think do best, which will include a disproportionate number of our posh people's own children. If we look at the self-harming rates amongst girls, other things that are going on, we're actually damaging the children of the upper middle class. I can be even more brutal about it. At a particular public school, which I won't name, which I was at a few years ago, the gardener, who's a lovely man who couldn't stop talking, was telling me about what happened to the boys and how they were made to work all the way through till 10 at night. If it hadn't been an expensive public school, you couldn't treat children in that kind of way. You can get an A star out of almost any boy, but I do wonder what damage you do forcing every boy at 18 to get an A star at A levels if their mum and dad have got a huge amount of money and get them in. So I'd look at that for policy. And look to Scotland, and look a bit to Wales, and don't keep on damning it and saying its results are awful. Look at the positive side of what's happening in Wales. Look to Ireland for a better way of admitting children to university after they get their results. And then look to the whole of mainland Europe. You know, it's not that the advantage of being the most unequal place in the world with some of the lowest stability and numeracy is that there's lots of places we can look for lessons. Lord knows what they're doing in Finland. Where do the Finns go to learn about how many? They look at Shanghai, but even, you know, in Shanghai they're pulling out of PISA because they're worried about the damage it does. And it's only, of course, a small portion of the kids who are in the study. It's the posh kids who count as resident. And just like those boys 18 in that top public school, you can get high PISA results out of a set of 15-year-olds if you teach them maths in a particular way. Doesn't teach them maths. But maths, I won't. I think I was slightly better at maths than my dad thinks I was. But maths can be really enjoyable and imaginative. But doing well in maths tests is not the way you learn what is really exciting about maths. Tipping point. It's very hard to predict. Our inequality levels are now back to where they were at the last maxima, which is around about 1913. Our inequality in voting, our segregation in voting is actually back to 1918 levels. That is, the Conservative Party are most popular in the southeast. They're very, very unpopular in most of the country. So if you were to use the past, we are numerically at a position where we were at a tipping point before. We became much more equal for 70 years after then. But a war helped, and a little revolution in Russia kind of frightened people at the top of British society, who became quite radical and invented the welfare state and so on. The reason to think that we may not get to a tipping point is that as a country becomes more unequal, the numeracy ability of its population actually drops. The US is worse than us, but we're worse than almost everywhere else. And people's ability to work out what's going on gets worse. So if you ask people what you think their children's chances are of doing really well, the more unequal a country, the more likely people are to say, my children are going to succeed and win. And they want to get rid of things like inheritance tax because they think their children are one day going to pay it. So we become collectively more stupid as we become more individualistic. And we find it, you know, hard to work out basic things. But the situation we find ourselves in at the moment, only one in four of the electorate voted for the Conservative Party. It's the most incredible geographical distribution ever. I think this is the most undemocratic election result in the history of democracies. I'd love it if one of you can find me an election where a quarter of the electorate has managed to get an overall majority of parliamentarians anywhere in the world. They don't quite manage it in the States because they only have two parties. So even having only just over 50% of people voting in the States still means that the president gets at least 26 or 27% of the electorate. So we've managed to beat the United States in being more undemocratic. There's nothing set in stone at all about our politics. It's really unpredictable over what's going to happen. And there's nothing set in stone about our economy. Our economy is still based on banks. It's still based on the massive debt that we have. is still based on the idea that we are selling an expertise in something we're not very good at to the rest of the world. It's still based on a really dodgy little currency called sterling that occasionally people decide to play with and cause a run on. That hasn't happened for a long time. If the Scots had, if just 5.5% of Scottish people had voted differently some year ago, you'd now be facing Scottish independence. Can you imagine how different that would then be for England? And how different it would be for sterling? What's sterling like, not even backed up by oil? We're going to sort Greece out, of course. Greece was just being made to go through an enormous amount of pain so that the Portuguese don't try it. But if things do go badly wrong in Europe, and Andy Haldane, a deputy executive of the Bank of England, the one that he's changing his job title, but Andy Haldane goes around the world saying how unsafe our banks are. We cannot predict the next 5 years. 2008 should have taught us one thing: that completely unpredictable can really happen. You can have rises in absolute poverty. You can bring back soup kitchens. If you told me in 2006 or 7 that within 5 years' time we'd have millions of people collecting food to feed other people, we'd have government cutting most from the disabled, we would have absolute rises in child poverty, and a prediction from the IFS that under every single measure of child poverty it is destined to go up dramatically by 2020, and that we were going to take child tax credits away from, I could go through it. If you told me all these things in 2007, I'd have said no. There's no way that could happen. So I think what we must learn from what has happened in the last 5 years is that there is absolutely no certainty for the next 5 years. And what we need to do is to start talking about what we want. What kind of society do we want to live in? Particularly, what kind of society do we want to live in? If we are not that richer country, and if you are not that richer country, you cannot afford to have people driving their children past other schools to other schools. You cannot afford to spend huge amounts of money on some children and not on others. You can't afford to be doing all these tests all the time. It costs money, apart from anything else. What kind of country do you want your children and your grandchildren to live in, particularly when you take a slightly smaller share of the world's wealth than we've been used to taking, because we were only 100 years ago the richest country in the world?
Thank you very much, Danny. I think, Ben, I think we're going to stop the questions there, the formal part. I'm hoping you can stay with us for a few minutes for drinks upstairs, so the drinks are up in chapters. Danny's really made us stop and think about what we care about and what our responsibilities are in terms of addressing these inequalities within our society, and I think we should all thank him again for that. And we just have to show that we are equitable in Brilliant. Terms of gender.
Yep.
We've got flowers for you.
That's great.
Thank you, Ben.
That's lovely.
Athena Swan officer for his department, so it's wonderful we give him flowers.
And that might be the first time anybody has ever given me flowers.
I'd also like to thank Sharon for very wise thoughts on how we take what Danny's been talking about this evening and translate it into our work, our studies, our research, our teaching here at King's. So thank you all for attending, and please join us for a drink upstairs. Thank you.